Welcome to Energy Stew. This is Peter Roth, your host. And I'd like to ask you, when was the last time you've been to Oz? And maybe you need to be there again soon. Maybe we all need to go to Oz and learn from it. And to help us learn from it is the author of a book called The Wizard of Us. Because Oz needs us and us needs Oz. And The Wizard of Us is written by an amazing author who I've known about for a long time. She's a visionary thinker, teacher, and philosopher, and has a very large following around the world, has done incredible work. She's written over 26 books, and I'm so glad she wrote this one, The Wizard of Us. Jean Houston, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you so much, Peter. It's good to be with you, and thank you for that very generous introduction.
Well, you deserve it, and the book deserves it, too, because I loved it, and I realized how much we need it. We need to use the whole journey of Dorothy and what it can do for us, and that's why you wrote the book, right?
Well, yes, it is. You know, it's sort of the iconic American story. You know, I've done so many books that it had to do with some of the great myths, Parsifal, you know, and the search for the Grail and all of those kinds of things. But I had never really done an American myth. I find, you know, I've worked in 108 countries for the UN and other international agencies, helping cultures deepen their capacities while they move into a world civilization. My work is both human development as well as social change, cultural change. But I find that people will go further and faster and deeper in expanding their bodies, their minds, their spirits, if it is attached to a story. So I, years ago, I had, with the help of the Department of Commerce, I went to 17 cities, and we never had less than 1,500 people. And I used the story of The Wizard of Oz as a journey of transformation for Normanac, Oklahoma, Raleigh, North Carolina, Vancouver, Canada. And it had tremendous effect. So many years later, I figured it was also helpful that we never charged more than $40, and that included for the whole weekend, the lunches. You know?
Wow, that's great.
But the story just doesn't go away, and it keeps coming up, and it's like people watch it on the movies. You know, at this point, well over a billion people have probably seen it, and their mouths go, "Oh, we're not in Kansas anymore." You know, it has become a kind of liturgical theme in the minds of so many people. Why? Why is this story so important? I think it's because it asks the great questions. Who are we? Where are we going? What is the nature of our life? Where is our meaning and purpose? How can we do more?
Right. It also
and especially
shows,
especially in this, the most critical time in human history, other times thought they were it. They're wrong. This is it.
It also shows how.
And how. Yeah. It's a primer into human and social possibilities.
Right.
And
you also talk about stories. And there are so many stories that have to do with conquering and destroying.
That's right.
And this is not that way. Even though Dorothy wins.
Yeah. She wins by mistake. She's
right.
Throwing the water on the burning scarecrow, and some of it falls on the witch. So the water of life destroys her beautiful wickedness.
Right. And Dorothy shows that she had no intention of destroying the witch. She just wanted to steal or get the slippers.
Mm-hmm. So it's a very potent story, and so what I try to do in the book is take people through the story as a journey of their own personal transformation and an activation of the deeper purposes of who they are and what they yet can be and how they can be of greater usefulness.
Well, it's a very important book because the processes that you work through and the stories that you tell about how people in this age have transformed life and how we can use the metaphors of Dorothy's journey to transform our own life. And so you also have different meditations in the book that are very well written, very powerful, easy to climb into and very enjoyable to experience because I think you're very talented with that kind of process.
Well, I've been at it for a very long time. You know, I've been around since God had baby teeth, so
uh-huh.
I'm actually going to have my 76th birthday in about a week and a half.
Gosh.
You know,
you're
I'll be in China at the time.
You're older than me. I'm 70.
You know, we're young things, you know.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, but that's interesting, Peter, because, you know, we have seen so much history. I mean, we have seen the equivalent of perhaps 1,500 years of history collapsed into the 70-odd years.
And we've also lived through the bubble of the mirage of a good world that's doing the right thing. And it wasn't.
And it wasn't, right. It wasn't.
And
I mean, as you on Progressive Radio, I think, show so lucidly and poignantly and powerfully.
Right, and so we're now in the Dust Bowl of Kansas.
That's right. Well, we are in the ecological collapse, and that's the whole point. You know, you know why the movie rather than the book? The book was written in 1900, and by the way, Frank Baum's great granddaughter got in touch with me, and she said, "I want you to know how great grandpa actually wrote this book," and she said, "Whoa, it was all a download, all at once." And so, and he himself said that it just sort of flowed out of his fingers on the pencil.
Right.
And the same way as J.R. Rowling received the Harry Potter, zoom, you know, a kind
sure.
of simultaneous all at once. The way Mozart received a great deal of his music.
Right.
He said it was zusammen, it's all at once.
Many
so
great.
So it's like it gestates in the womb of preparatory time and then rises in the mind of these deeply receptive people.
It's amazing.
When time and space are ready.
I know, it's amazing how divinely inspired we are. Now, I want to talk about that because in the book, you make a big deal about Glinda, the Good Witch of
yes.
the North,
mm-hmm.
and how we all need Glindas in our life.
Yes.
And you speak of her as an intellige. And it's not a word that most people are familiar
entelechy,
with.
Yes.
Entelechy, yes. Okay, that's mm-hmm. I'm not even familiar with
entelechy,
hearing
Greek
it. I'm only familiar with it, seeing it in print.
Yeah.
And so we have entelechies, and Glinda is an entelechy, and what does that mean for the rest of us who mm-hmm. don't necessarily see a Glinda wandering around?
Well, entelechy, the Greek word was first used in this way by Aristotle, when he says it's the entelechy of an acorn to be an oak tree, when it's the entelechy of a baby to be a grown-up human being. It's the deeper, purposeful, higher pattern that is there in all of our lives. And many people go through life without ever knowing that they have it. But when you study, as I have for so many years, the actual structure of the human psyche, you find that this is a major potential of our lives. You can think of it as the essence self, yourself, as if you'd had 1,000 years to do your human homework, or just your higher guidance. You can give it a spiritual form, or you can give it a psychological, or even a cosmic form. So in the book, I actually give you an exercise in which you get in touch with this higher entelechy. And people who do so, and I've received hundreds and hundreds of letters from people from all over the world, because, you know, the book is doing very well, and saying, well, since I've gotten in touch with this, my life has just been going into an extraordinary series of adventures, surprises, and wonders, because the entelechy is part of the higher design for your deeper life, which we all need to live in this, as I say, this most awesome and challenging of times.
And maybe it's the part of us that's higher intelligently
yes.
than our minds, and more powerful, can see more and do more, as Glinda would represent for us.
Yes, as she does in the book. So one of the things is we know, I am something of a cosmologist. That's my great hobby is cosmology. And I would have to say, just as we live in the universe certainly lives in us, because we're designed in many of the same ways. And this, it's a way of sort of tuning in to the universal aspects of ourselves, which really has only our higher good, but to put it within a very personal way. Because if we just say, oh, the universe and I are walking together, doesn't quite come off for most people. You
right,
know?
Right, because we only know ourselves as in this limited mind and body.
Because I attends to thou much more than I will attend to it, you see. Mm-hmm. I attend to Glinda rather than to cosmic consciousness.
And once we become more familiar with that greater sense of self, for instance, that we actually have a soul journey that's been around before, and we have a higher self, a part of our soul that is actually even beyond us, that is part of us. Those are cosmological understandings that can help us be more grounded in a sense of some reality, even though science might not understand it. So I want to talk about the power that this entelechy can create in the role of Toto.
Yes, yes. The animating force, the only animating force back in Kansas.
Right.
And the little dark Norwich Terrier. Is that
right?
A cute
one? Right, but it was also a force in Oz, too.
Yes, huge. I mean, he leads the way. He energizes. He gets people going. When she's there in the witch's castle and the witch has turned the hourglass around and it's running out, you know, the great lines. I love those lines. Run, Toto, run! and he goes and pulls everybody back. He is the great connector the connector between our situation, our challenge, and the solution.
Well, run, Toto, run is something that you also ask us to hold within ourselves and use it a lot in our lives when we feel stuck, when we need help, to ask our little Toto inside of us to go for help.
Well, I am passionately a dog person. You know, I in part was raised by a dog, and one of my best books is called Mystical Dogs. You know, dogs is that which evokes some of our higher forms of consciousness. So the fact that he puts it, that Frank Baum put it in the importance of this little dog. Are you a dog person?
No, I'm not, actually.
Well, you should be.
I like them. I have many friends who adore dogs in ways and that I know that I'm not, but I have nothing against them, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm.
We all have our focus, and we're all drawn to different energies. And I get happy when I see people loving dogs.
Mm-hmm.
So it's...
So we forgive you then.
Thank you. I'm a good guy, really. So we want to talk about this... the role of Toto as a quantum partner that you mentioned that name, mm-hmm. quantum partner.
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean to you?
Well, the whole notion of the quantum universe, this great energetic field which informs the basis of all existence and, you know, and pops up in particular ways in our lives, whether it pops up as the friend or the word that we need at that moment. A quantum partner is that which energizes your everyday acts, which lures you into your new becoming, and yet is there as a very beneficent being. So certainly little Toto and his tremendous actions throughout the movie and the book is part of that, what I would call the unexpected grace that appears in our lives, but is really part of the higher purposes, plans, and ignition of the quantum field in our life.
That's great. I was just remembering that a good friend is the granddaughter of the producer of the film, Wizard of Oz, and she loves dogs.
Good for her.
And she has one of the original pairs of slippers. So it's a beautiful book in it, in the way that we can hold ourselves, to give ourselves the opportunity to come out of Kansas, to change our lives using the quantum partner, using our entelechy, and also using the metaphors of her three helpers that she travels with.
Yes, yes. That's a major piece of my book, because her three helpers are also disenfranchised parts of herself. The disenfranchised mind, the scarecrow, disenfranchised heart, the tin man, disenfranchised courage, the cowardly lion. And what happens is that in the course of the story, not only do they get re-enfranchised, but the scarecrow discovers that he's really brilliant. The tin man is the most empathic and sensitive of beings, and the cowardly lion does immensely courageous acts. So what I do in the book is give people a way of accessing different domains and capacities of their mind, their brains, and this has been part of my expertise for many, many years, you know, brain research, how to access the fullness of the heart, how to access the tremendous powers of our innate courage, you know. So I give very practical exercises in doing this.
I found them very helpful.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, and also the stories of people with heart and courage that
yes.
you talk about in the book. And so you've been really a great guide in this to help us come alive again. It's like when Dorothy meets the Scarecrow, she really helps him get his mind going.
Well, not only that, but look at her own compassion. You see, this is how the feminine heroine's journey differs a little bit from most of the classical male journeys. You know, she takes him off the hook where he's been perched, you know, and where even the crows laugh at him. She gets him down. She oils up the Tin Man. She really both balls out and activates the lion, and then creates the team, which is really the team of her own higher powers, which she had forgotten in Kansas, where, you know, nobody paid any attention to her. Eddie M., I got to tell you. Oh, go away, Dorothy. Can't you see? We're counting the chickens.
Right. Right.
Why can't you go somewhere where you're not bothering people? Well, where is it? And then that tremendous, incredible song, you know, Somewhere Over the Rainbow, which almost did not make it into the movie, by the way.
Wow.
But that song of yearning, of being called. I mean, how many people out there, because of the nature and critical issues of our time, feel called to rise above their little local situation? And to move over the rainbow from this reality into the deeper reality that is calling them.
Sometimes they need a tornado to do it.
Well, they do, don't they? I mean, whatever the tornado is, sickness, illness, divorce, loss of job, or just the sheer muchness of their life, and it picks them up and it puts them someplace else. I've been in a tornado. I mean, not in it, but I've been certainly whisked by me. And I tell you, it is a very powerful thing. As I think I write in the book, it gobbles up landscapes. It's a gourmand of landscapes, cornfields, houses. And yet it can also pick things up and then put them 100 miles away without hurting them. But it is it's nature's deviant player.
And a lot of people,
often it takes that kind of tornado, psychological tornado, right, to get us moving.
And a lot of people feel that we're in that right now, mm-hmm. and are motivated to move, wow. Although there's so much media out there that is the poppy field of the book.
It is the poppy where we fall asleep so that we will not really rise to the occasion of who and what we really, really are. Yeah, you know, the poppy field is, to me, it's two things. It's just as you said, it's the trying to keep us, lull us into same old, and just buy and consume. Or it is where one of the strange phenomenons of being human, you nearly are at the goal, and then you go to sleep, or you say, well, I'll do this, I'm nearly there, I'll do this later, and then you lose the momentum.
And it's amazing how much the media is trying to keep us asleep.
Yeah, very much so.
And in many confusing ways as well. If they tell us one thing enough, if they lie enough to us, mm-hmm. then we don't know what truth to believe.
Well, let me tell you something that happened to me last week. I was giving a seminar in Cape Cod, and so the only way out of Cape Cod is to go home is Boston. So there we were. At 3 o'clock, you know, heading more or less in the direction of the airport, and I saw the smoke. So we get to the airport, and here come the marathon runners who had been, gone over the line at 1 o'clock, and they were filled with triumph, and they didn't know anything was happening because it hadn't happened while they were on the way to the airport. And they come in, and they're so filled with exuberance and delight and joy and triumph. And then as they stand on the line, the very, very, very long lines, what has just happened goes viral as a message throughout all of them. and to see this the ironic dialectic between triumph and tragedy. So I spent my time, because it was a very long time in the airport and then on the plane, long plane ride across the country, you know, talking to the marathoners and saying, you know, trying to help them make sense of what happened, you know, of the triumph and the tragedy, and what can they do in themselves to ameliorate the tragedy, to make a world better so that these things do not have to happen. And so this became a very, very, very critical point in my life in this past year.
Yes, and I was at a memorial service yesterday in Central Park, exactly a week after the bomb went off. I'm one of the former directors of the marathon in New York. Mm-hmm. And how affected everybody yesterday was by it. But there's also a lot of resolve to move on powerfully.
Yes.
And I think that's the way you were helping
people. Yes, that's right, to move on, but also to make a difference. That you cannot rest on your laurels anymore. I mean, because the 13.7 billion year experiment that has resulted is in our lives, you know, is in trouble right now. And that's why why I live the life of a 35-year-old professional woman all over the world, trying to help people activate the deeper resources of their capacities and their consciousness so that they rise to the challenge of making the better world.
Right.
And but it only happens from inside out, Peter. It is not. Yes. I've attended too many places where people magisterially put signatures on big documents, and I know perfectly well that very little will happen. Because unless it is shifted from inside out, it's not going to happen.
From inside out, we're looking at this evolutionary imperative that Andrew Cohen talks about. He's been a guest on the show a couple of times.
Oh, good. He's a wonderful guy. He's an old friend of mine.
Yes, and he is such a making so many strong statements about this inner imperative that we're all dealing with now, facing this, you know, looking at this poppy field of everyone being asleep and trying to wake everyone up and doing it in creative, resourceful, integral ways. And you're one of the big speakers for the integral culture.
Well, you see, it's not just a matter of speaking, as you know. It's a matter of doing. It's a matter of retraining the self and the body and mind in ways that our traditional education simply has not done. And it's above all, it's a way of calling people to their higher purpose and to know that they have an enormous opportunity of profoundly making a difference in this, the most critical time in human history.
And each in their own way.
Each in their own way. It can be something very simple. It can be as simple as a certain kind of volunteerism to help people locally in community or women in a shelter or you know, creating wonderful after school projects for children, teaching them carpentry or you know, service. I was a Girl Scout for many, 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 many years, and I was a Girl Scout in New York City. I even got the beekeeping badge, which was hard to do in New York City.
Right, on rooftops.
But I found that the emphasis that we had on service, on learning things to be of use has stayed with me my whole life.
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
And so we come back to the Wizard of Us, and I believe we really need to keep seeing ourselves on that yellow brick road.
Yes.
And
the road of spiritual pollen, it's called.
And in the discovery of the Emerald City,
mm-hmm.
and creating the Emerald City. And so,
well,
yes.
Yeah,
ahead.
I mean, these are the times in which we reimagine, rewire, repattern, begin to look for the best practices to create new forms of community and consciousness. But it starts with consciousness. It doesn't start with, okay, let's go and let's make a better world, because often you're doing that out of sheer muscularity and not out of the deep inner training and sensitivity that is required.
Right. To be able to hear our entelechy.
Exactly. Yes.
Yes. And so you talk also about how to make the journey better through the power of joy and laughter.
Well, you know, I'm the daughter of a comedian.
Oh, I didn't know that.
My father is the guy who wrote the joke, "Who's on first?"
Oh, wow.
Although, frankly, Peter, I think it was he and two Jewish guys, because when you look at the joke, it's positively Talmudic. And my dad was an agnostic Baptist from Texas.
Interesting.
Now, my dad wrote the Bob Hope Show, Burns and Allen, Edgar Bergen and Charlie McCarthy and all those shows. I grew up in show business. Uh-huh.
I grew up with a cartoonist father.
Did you really?
Yes.
And now, wait a minute. What was your father's name?
Ben Roth.
I know the name. I know it. I know
he
it.
And his three brothers, Al Ross, who was a New Yorker cartoonist,
yes.
was a Roth, but he changed it to Ross because my father took on the name Roth first in the cartoon business.
Yeah.
So anyway, we only have a few minutes left, and
yes.
I think talking about joy and laughter is very important because
yes.
it keeps our hearts stronger as we move forward.
Well, laughter is the key, I think, to higher consciousness. How about that? Nobody's ever said that to you.
I like it.
But I really think it is, because when you laugh, what happens? It's not just 15 muscles, interconnecting. It's actually the sheer delightful absurdities of the world put together and creating essentially a new universe. The smartest people I have ever met in my life have been comedians, because they're always reinventing the world and turning it upside down. Laughter is this huge release, isn't it?
Right. And that's why we like Jon Stewart so much.
Yes, yes. And the others, yeah.
Uh-huh.
And it's interesting. In this country, it's interesting. It's been a Jewish cottage industry.
Right.
My father was often the only non-Jewish person in the comedy teams for these shows. They would say, "Hey, Jack, go issue up these jokes so the Hicks in Kansas will understand it."
Did he ever visit the Catskills?
Yes. Yeah. No, I don't think he ever did, but I
okay.
certainly did.
Well, that's where so many comedians were.
But
so,
the power of laughter is one of the greatest powers that
yes.
they have. You know, I think in the book I talk about the old Apache tale that goes, the Creator made man able to do everything, talk, run, look, and hear. He was not satisfied, though, until the man could do just one more thing, and that was laugh. And so man laughed and laughed and laughed, and the Creator said, "Now you are fit to live."
All right, and now we're fit to move forward. And to do that, I want to encourage everybody to buy The Wizard of Us by Gene Houston. Gene, it's so wonderful to talk with you. It's a privilege because I've known about you for decades,
mm-hmm.
and it's an opportunity that I'm glad I have today.
Well, thank you. And by the way, people can go to my website, genehouston.com, if they want to find out more about things that we're doing.
That's great. Gene, thank you so much for being
thank
a guest
so much,
on
Peter.
Energy Stew. And all the best.
All the best to you, Peter.
Thank you. And this is Peter Roth, your host of Energy Stew at ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. I can be reached at peter@heartriver.org, or 212-222-7748. And thank you so much for listening.